This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist educator at Colby College, the coordinator of the Freedom in Captivity Initiative, and a current Soros Justice Fellow. Today, I am delighted to be talking with Nicole Lund, who is a visual artist, writer, prison abolition advocate, and graduate student at the University of Maine at Farmington. She's been volunteering at the Maine State Prison, helping residents tell their stories through visual narrative. And today we're going to talk about her newest project, an unusual cookbook that she's co-authored with her friend Buddy Beeler called Stuffed Behind Bars, Secret Recipes from Inside Maine State Prison. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Hi, thank you, Catherine, for having me here.
So delighted to have this conversation. I want to start off by saying that I know that we're both really sorry that Buddy is not allowed to join us today from Maine State Prison to record this episode. And I just want to acknowledge his absence. So greetings to Buddy. I want to start by reading the online description of your remarkable cookbook. This comes directly from its page on Amazon. Stuffed Behind Bars, Secret Recipes from Inside Maine State Prison is a collection of recipes, tips, tricks, and conversations between Buddy and Nicole. It's no secret prison food is terrible, but Buddy took the time to figure out how to make better meals for him and his friends with what they had available. More than a cookbook, Stuffed Behind Bars speaks to the importance of community, connection, and food. If you've fallen on hard times and have little more than a microwave and hope for a better tomorrow, this book is for you. So let's get some history for this project. How did you and Buddy first meet?
So I met Buddy while I was interning at the Maine State Prison. I was facilitating an art workshop for the residents inside over the summer. And Buddy's job at the time was the art room facilitator. And so he was the one who, you know, made sure that the class was advertised and all the art supplies were available and ready and the room was set up. And yeah, we were kind of like really fast friends. Yeah, he has a really great sense of humor and he's so personable, and he made me feel very comfortable there. And we just chatted a lot and talked and.
So you both clearly have a creative spirit. And so can you talk a little bit about what was the road between you giving an art workshop and Buddy setting up the room and facilitating, you know, sort of the logistics of the room and writing a cookbook together? That's kind of a long road.
It was a 3-month workshop that I was running. It was actually for an internship for my undergrad. And, you know, after the summer workshop was over, we kind of realized we were going to miss each other and we were going to miss working together. And so, you know, he was like, well, could I call you? And I didn't really see why not. The way I saw it, we were colleagues. I came in and ran a workshop. He was helping me facilitate it and we were friends. So I didn't really see much wrong with that. My workshop was over. I wasn't actively volunteering at the time. And so he did, he started calling me. I mean, we were talking on the phone a lot and just laughing. And, the more we got to know each other, the more we realized how well we got along and that we really could work well together. So unfortunately, I was not supposed to be talking to him on the phone. And when I went back in the fall to start another workshop series, I became banned from volunteering because the administration found out about the phone calls we were having that were prohibited. Yeah, but because it wasn't really anything beyond phone calls that I did that kind of broke the volunteer agreement, we were allowed to continue being friends and talking on the phone. They did block my phone number for a while and mail and communication. But once that was, you know, once the, they put me through a whole investigation, and once that was over, they kind of were like, oh, she didn't really do that much other than talk on the phone. So, you know, we just continued talking and realized it was kind of like, we kind of had this idea like, oh, hey, wouldn't it be fun to write a cookbook? And because he kept telling me about food and like what they make from commissary ingredients inside, it kind of just seemed like a fun idea. And it was, we had a great time doing it together. It was really difficult being able to do it because we were only allowed to talk on the phone and text and snail mail.
I mean, this is really, it is a labor of love. It's also a labor of enormous creativity. I want to pause before we go on to talking about the cookbook to just recognize the story that you just told, which has a pathos to it. You know, you go in as a volunteer, you form a relationship with a person on the inside, you care about each other, and that's criminalized. Determined to be something that is unacceptable. Like, you're not allowed to do that. It's against volunteer policy. You can't form relationships with people if you're a volunteer, even if you are aligned with each other in a colleague status. And so I want to just pause to note the weirdness of that. What
Yeah,
do
and
you
as you're saying too, like a colleague status, right? So I was just a volunteer facilitating a workshop. He was facilitating that. He was the art room facilitator. So I mean, we very much kind of saw each other as peers working together. But when I was being interrogated, it was interesting the language that the detective used, because he said, "So I want to set up, I want to understand what the situation is here." He goes, "You were teaching a course at MSP, and Buddy was one of your students." And I thought that was really interesting language, that he kind of wanted to put it in those terms of, where there was some sort of like differential
Right,
in
so
our
sort of power inequity because
yeah, permanent.
the prison is unable to recognize that people who are incarcerated there might actually be colleagues with people with whom they're working, and that's a real shortcoming, I think, in our prison system. Just to editorialize for a minute, because people, when they get out, need to know how to have collegial relationships, and if they're forbidden from doing that on the inside with people with whom they're working on the outside, that strikes me as a major shortcoming. So
Yeah,
thank you
thanks.
for mentioning that. I'm sorry that happened to you. It can't have been fun to be subjected to an investigation. I know myself something about that. And I'm glad that my understanding is you're no longer allowed to be a volunteer, but you can be now a visitor and a friend.
Yes. Yeah. So that was what ended up happening. They made me wait a year before I could submit a visitor application. But then after the year, they respected it and let me do that. So yeah. So now I'm a visitor.
Motivation for a year wait, do you know?
I'm not really sure. I mean, we've had some conversations about it, and I almost feel like it was, I think it was like kind of a test, it felt like, which sounds silly, but it sort of felt a little bit like that, like, oh, you want to be friends with them? Like, well, we'll make you wait a year and see if you still want to be friends
You
with them.
want to be friends with him? Okay, right. We don't believe that that's possible. Well, I'm glad you waited a year. I'm glad that you were able to resume your friendship. And I'm really delighted about, what has come out of that. So, first, you started with a YouTube channel. Can you tell us about that?
We did, yeah. So that was a real challenge. I was actually learning video editing through our YouTube channel. we wanted to both be on it, and obviously, and so it was our project together. And we were kind of, we knew we were going to be doing this cookbook, and so we've been working on it. We wanted to get some hype up around it, and we thought it would be really fun to do some, kind of like teasers about the cookbook coming out. So it was it was challenging because I had, my iPhone and a MacBook, and that's kind of what I did it all on. So I would record our phone calls and then go in and edit them into the videos. And I'm terribly camera shy too. That's why you don't really see my face in any of them. But
No, I remember seeing some of the videos, and we're watching you prepare the food. The buddy's telling you what to do, and so you're in the kitchen, and he's calling in, and he's giving you instructions, and all we can see is you basically from the neck down or from the waist down, mixing up the instructions that buddy's narrating over the phone. They're delightful videos if anybody wants to go watch them. You
Oh,
should.
thank you. The interesting thing too about, our original intention was to, have it be kind of like a little cooking show sort of a thing. But there were so many things that occur in the prison that felt like important issues to talk about. And so that video that we have, Eclipse Burrito, about when we had the solar eclipse here in Maine, and the guys were promised glasses, and that they were going to be able to go out and witness it. And then kind of last minute, they all got locked in. And so that actually happened on a day that we were supposed to be just filming a video about making burritos in prison. And so it felt like that was a more important issue to highlight than burritos.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And the sort of the trilogy that you remark on about, the relationship between community connection and food is really, I think, resonant here with the ways in which you two are cooking together across prison walls, which is remarkable. And you're building a cookbook together, but then it's also an opportunity to talk about these kinds of, like, just basically human issues around what happens behind prison walls and what are the sorts of ongoing daily disappointments that somebody's got to navigate about something as, seemingly minor as being allowed to see a once in a lifetime eclipse. So I'm sure that that was really meaningful for both of you to have that ability to connect through food and then allow food to be your conduit to talk about life and what you're both experiencing. So the YouTube videos are teasers. What were some of the topics that you talked about as you were cooking together over YouTube or over the phone and across prison walls?
I mean, some of the topics, like in regards to food, I was really sad to hear that since COVID, they don't eat in the mess hall together anymore.
Right.
That was really striking to me. You know, you talk about community, that concept of being able to share a meal with people. And it was just, it made me really sad to think about all these guys kind of eating alone off a tray in their room. And
So for our listeners, since COVID, when the chow hall was shut down, now prisoners are called to chow at in groups, and you go in, you get your food, and you go back to your cell and you eat it there.
yeah, it's sad. Just kind of, it made me, made me sad to hear that, because I feel like such a big part of food and cooking is being able to share it with people you care about.
Yeah, I agree. And so the cookbook, I think it's 88 pages. How many recipes is in it?
Oh gosh, I forget now. It's about 30.
Yeah,
So many recipes.
about 3 dozen. And is it divided, like, what's the structure? Did you divide it into like the classic cookbook divisions, appetizers, soups, stews,
That's
casseroles?
kind of how we did it. We have like breakfast and the, small plates and snacks, entrees, desserts. And we have an intro that kind of talks about the theme of community and connection and how it relates to food. And there's a beautiful foreword written by Esther Chong, who is a DACA advocate, and she really bridges that concept of community across different issues, right? Because I mean, that's something that, like, connection is hugely important to everybody. And where immigration was her advocacy issue for so long, it's so relevant to that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, can you talk a little bit about how food, like sort of the politics of food in prison? How we already talked about how people get food from the chow hall, but the idea that prisoners are cooking, and can you tell us a little bit about how they do that? Like, what resources do they have access to? What are they allowed to cook with, and what do they cook in? How do they get their cook?
Well, yeah, so we have, so those are some of the tips and tricks that we have in our cookbook, actually, is how the how to. So how they, make a colander and make a stinger and all these different things to be able to cook. But I mean, other than that, it's like a microwave and plasticware, essentially, that they have access to. And sometimes they can swipe stuff from the kitchen, but mostly it's just things that they get out of commissary, which are ingredients that are, kind of equivalent to like what you would buy at a gas station convenience store. Sort of things, like minute rice and like summer sausage and those kinds of things. So because the prison food is so terrible, and it's often too the same companies that provide food to the kitchen that provide the food to commissary. So, they don't necessarily have it in their interest, like financially, to care if the food that they're getting in the kitchen is enough, or because a for-profit company that they're getting their food from. Yeah. So the guys, they use the money off their books to buy things at a commissary, and then they kind of have to make it better because it's not very good food. But they come up, and there's a lot of things they miss too, I mean, so we have a recipe in there for spare ribs and fried rice. Because like, who doesn't love Chinese food, like classic American Chinese food. So they've been so creative in the ways that they are able to replicate these sorts of things inside with a microwave and again, plasticware.
It's amazing. This is Justice Radio, and today I'm talking with Nicole Lund, co-author with Buddy Beeler of the new cookbook called Stuffed Behind Bars: Secret Recipes from Inside Maine State Prison. So let's get to the recipes themselves, Nicole. So we know that people who have money on the books can buy food from commissary. And they can take food out of the chow hall. They're not really supposed to, but little pats of butter, ketchup, jam, peanut butter, stuff like that. And then in their cells, mix it together to create new dishes that maybe are never available to them. And so you just talked about spare ribs and fried rice. Can you tell us another couple of recipes that maybe are particularly creative or particularly inventive that surprised you when Buddy said, "All right, this is what we're cooking today"?
Well, the salmon recipe that's in there kind of surprised me, because I was like, how did you get salmon? And his response was, don't ask questions I can't answer. Kind of cracked me up. But it's delicious. It's great. I made it at home in my own microwave, and it was a fantastic. So that one's exceptionally good. And then you always hear about like prison cakes, and so there's a couple of cake recipes in there and a lot of dessert things.
Tell us about a prison cake. What is a prison cake?
Prison cake, well, so they kind of take apart other desserts to reform it into a cake. And so we have one there, it's cookies. And so you kind of like separate the Oreos from the cream and change them all around in order to make a birthday cake for somebody.
And you can put coffee powder, whip it into the Oreo centers, turn that into coffee cream that you can frost something with. It's amazing how inventive you can be with what you can with the
Yeah.
crap you can buy out of commissary.
It is really amazing. Yeah.
So Nicole, you volunteered inside the prison. You have a longstanding relationship now with Buddy around food and sharing the sorts of inventive, creative use of food that Buddy's engineered inside with his colleagues on the inside, sharing that with an outside audience, making the point about how it's possible to create community through food with actually very, very little, and the importance of food for creating community. And all of this, I think, is interesting in relationship to the way that you describe yourself as a prison abolition advocate. So I wanted to get to that too and ask you what you mean by that. What does it mean to be a prison abolition advocate?
Well, so you hear about prison reform and you hear about prison abolition. And prison reform is the assumption that we can take the system we already have and kind of make it better. Prison abolition is no, we need to just tear it down to the ground and rebuild it. And that's really what I feel like we need to do. The prison system, it's like using up resources that could be better diverted to just preventing people from ever needing to go to prison, which is the way I see it. You think about, especially in Maine, like the lack of social services that we have, and the lack of like special education services and housing crisis, and there's so many things going on that we would be so much better off diverting our resources towards than keeping people who have been rehabilitated locked up for the rest of their lives.
So that's interesting. Keeping people who have been rehabilitated. What does it mean to be rehabilitated?
Well, there's so many people in there who came from, these terrible situations, developed trauma, developed substance abuse, kind of got caught up in the system at an incredibly young age. I mean, there were guys in there who, the first time they were incarcerated, they were 13 years old back at the Maine Youth Center, which is now Long Creek. And when somebody's caught up in the system, it's incredibly difficult to get out. Their lives get out of control, something major happens, and now they suddenly have a 50-year sentence, a 75-year sentence, or life sentence. And, they're in their early 20s at this time. And they're going to be in prison for the rest of their lives. I mean, you think about who you were when you were 20. I'm guessing you're not the same person right now. Yeah. And I think about that with myself. I mean, like it's, to be like constantly punished for the rest of your life for a mistake you made when you were, 20, 21, 22 years old is insane. And so that's it. People outgrow crime, and they, so when basically prison, what it does, it kind of just puts, like hits the pause button on your life, and you get removed from society. And but you're still growing up. You're just growing up in this different environment now. So I mean, by the time someone's 35, 40 years old, like they're a completely different person. And a lot of times like they're no longer on substances at this point, and they've spent a lot of time alone thinking about who they were and who they want to be. And they'll never have the opportunity to be able to come back to society and contribute to their community and really atone for and make an amends for the harm that they caused. They're just caged. And it's a
Sorry.
shame.
Yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame for all of us. And one of the things that you alluded to earlier, I want to bring up, it's not just that prisons cause harm by eating up resources that could be, perhaps you're arguing, better used to stop harm from happening in the first place, but also that prisons are vehicles for profitability for the corporations that provision prisons. And so, has Buddy shared with you anything about the costs of commissary items?
Well, I know from sending, I've sent him care packages from outside website that you can send care packages in. And I was dumbfounded because it's like the same stuff you can get off of Walmart, only much more expensive. And then you get to pay for shipping on top of it, which is crazy. I tried sending him hot sauce one time off of Amazon and it got sent back. They wouldn't give it to him. Which kind of blew my mind. But I was like, it's the same hot sauce. What's the difference? But I'm not giving the money to the right company,
I was going to
basically.
say the difference is who gets the profit.
That's exactly what it is. And all of these companies, I mean, they say that, technically we have a nonprofit prison system here in Maine, but all of these companies that supply to the prison in way like, GTL, like with their phones and texting and in the Keefe Group and WellPath and all these other organizations, those are all for-profit companies that are making a huge amount of money off of these people being incarcerated.
So not only is Buddy paying the commissary prices to produce the meals that he's making for himself and his comrades inside, but he's also paying for the phone calls to call you to be able to tell you what to cook in your kitchen and to have the conversations around cookbooks. Can you talk a little bit about the cost of phone calls?
Yeah, it's pretty expensive. It was $3 for 30 minutes, which really adds up. You're trying to write an entire book with somebody.
Yeah.
And 15 cents a text message. Now they actually just got a new they got these new tablets, and the promise of the new tablets was that they would be able to make phone calls from their room, and they'd be able to, people on the outside could send pictures in and they could video call, but the reception is really terrible. So he's tried calling me from his room before, and it like cuts out, calls drop, and it's just as expensive for really terrible service. So it's been tough.
And one of the things, about,
Expensive.
sorry.
It's been tough and expensive. Yeah.
Expensive trying to maintain a relationship around food and cooking. Yeah, and this is I think a really relevant point for the larger point that you're making again about food connection and community, which is all these barriers that are put in place for people on the outside to maintain connections with people on the inside. Your connection with Buddy started through art and it blossomed through food. But what you had to be willing to do to maintain that connection, the high cost of the items that Buddy is buying to teach you how to cook with it, the high cost of the phone calls, obviously the year-long waiting period that you had to be put through. It's just remarkable to me how difficult it is made for people on the inside to have healthy, loving relationships with people on the outside because of these kinds of barriers and walls and interruptions and disruptions. And I'm wondering if you have any way of making sense of that. Why is it so hard?
I don't know. I've thought about it. I think that I almost feel like the Department of Corrections, if they really saw these guys succeeding in meaningful ways and being able to maintain healthy relationships with people and all these things, and it would kind of prove that their existence is pointless. I mean, I hate to say it quite like that, but it is kind of, it's like they need to believe that these people are all monsters and that they're not capable of succeeding. They're not capable of, being members of community. Because if they are, then why are they there?
Wow, that's very hard hitting. Thank you. Let's turn back to the cookbook. Tell me your favorite recipe.
My favorite recipe. I really like the Fat Bastard, honestly. I love a
That's
big
a
fatty
lie.
breakfast
You're not allowed
sandwich.
to have that in prison. What is the fat bastard?
It's a bagel sandwich with like cheese sauce, fried eggs, fried meat, jalapeno. I love jalapenos. So in melted cheese. Yeah.
Fat Bastard, the name that you two gave to it, or is that the name inside that's given to
So that's the name that Buddy told me. It's funny because I've seen other prison recipes. I guess like it's kind of a thing. You hear about like trash bag soup. Like that's another one of those like prison, like kind of classic prison recipes. Apparently Fat Bastard is sort of a classic prison recipe too, but it's just, it's made differently across different facilities and in different states, but it's kind of one of those titles.
Is there a recipe that Buddy was narrating to you, and you were like, "This looks terrible. I cannot imagine somebody came up with this."
There was one. So the tuna melt recipe blew my mind. Like he was like, we're gonna make tuna melts. And I'm like, okay. So I'm thinking of like a normal tuna melt. You have two pieces of bread and melted cheese and tuna fish. And he's like, he's like, you're gonna need some ramen noodles. I'm like, what? Like, that doesn't make sense. And I was surprised, but I was surprised at how good it was.
So,
It's like an open face. What's that?
talk us through it.
So it's an open face tuna melt. So you slice a bagel in half and you have the two halves. You make the ramen noodles, you mix up the tuna fish, mix it all together with there's some herbs and seasonings in there. And
Wow.
everything gets hot pepper when I make it, so there's hot pepper in it. And then you put the noodles with the tuna fish on top of each bagel half, and then with shredded cheese on top, and you microwave them to melt all the cheese and melt it all together. And it's so good. I was surprised at how good it is. It's
That's
funny. I actually made those with Buddy's mom. We don't have a video on it, but it was funny. I went to Buddy's mom's house to visit her, and we made them together. Her and I. We were both like, "Wow!" Like we weren't expecting it to be good. Yeah.
That's shocking to me. I can't promise that I'm going to go try it, but I might. It's intriguing enough. I can see how the flavor of the ramen would intensify the sort of blandness of the tuna and make something really delicious. So, wow. And what about a recipe that you tried that he told that, he narrated to you and you tried it and you were like, no, this is terrible. This is not going in the cookbook.
There actually weren't any. There weren't any like that. The one thing I really struggled with making fried rice in the microwave. There were a lot of outtakes on that because I actually used to own a Thai restaurant before. I was a Thai chef for 7 years, and so like I know how to make fried rice. And he was telling me how to do it in the microwave, and it was like my brain couldn't process what he was telling me.
Like, this does not
So
work.
I struggled with that one, but I finally got the technique down and was able to do it. And so I was able to articulate in the recipe how it's done.
The
But that
people
was
who are like, how do you do this in a microwave? That's amazing.
It took that one. I struggled. I really struggled.
That's hilarious. I'm reminded of I had a fellowship in South Africa, and I was put up. I had rented a room that was supposed to come with a kitchen, and the kitchen was a sink and a microwave, and that was it. And I don't have a microwave at home. I don't have no idea how to cook with a microwave. And the proprietor said to me, "You can cook everything in a microwave." And I moved locations because I was like, "I will starve to death. I don't even know how to turn the thing on, much less cook anything worth eating." So
See,
for
it's too bad you didn't know Buddy, because he would
I
have
didn't
showed
know this was before I
you.
Buddy. I could have eaten so well if I only I'd known. So are there any dishes in your cookbook that are of Buddy's own design, things that he came up with himself inside?
Oh, the salmon recipe. Yeah, that was his own doing. Yeah. And there were a couple other too. There's a fish stew recipe and the chowder recipes that he's. Yeah, I mean, they're kind of, some of them were joint efforts of him and the guys. But there was a lot of, as he puts it, like years of experimenting and years of
Yeah.
ruinings.
Here's a, oops. So, Nicole, do you have a
Yeah.
second project coming along? Do
I'm sorry, what?
you have a second project now
We
that you're
do.
into?
Yeah.
What is it?
So the original intention with this book, we were thinking about how, if this first book goes well, we would kind of turn into a series highlighting different aspects of people's lives. And so, this first one was about cooking and connection. And the next book we were talking about is would be Cuffed and Buffed, How to Stay Prison Jacked in a Small Space, where we talk about how, the importance of health and staying in shape and taking care of your body and like what the mind-body connection. We
Wow.
also, get your gains even if you're limited in space.
Even if you're locked into a tiny 6x9 cell with another grown man. Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much for making the time to talk with us on Justice Radio, Nicole Lund. With thanks to bluesman Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, to Aaron Pyle, our sound engineer, and to Daria Cullen, our executive producer. I'm Catherine Besteman. We are Justice Radio.